The Word of Mouth Daily Podcast is brought to you by
Doucette Survey,
serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England,
now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com. And
Dartmouth Hitchcock,
creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system
improving the health of our communities
for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h. Org.
Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. At 5,525 miles, the border between the U.S. and Canada is the longest and pretty much the friendliest in the world. Relations between the two nations are generally cheery, apart from the Revolutionary War, the War of 1812, assorted dust-ups, a misunderstanding over the shooting of a pig, and that episode of West Wing, when a standoff between some hunters and Mounties escalated into an international incident.
Enough. This is stopping now. The problem is not a few rowdy outlaws from a bygone era blowing off testosterone. The problem is us. We're still the wild bunch. I mean, the higher it goes, the hotter the risk. I just threatened the Canadian ambassador.
Well, once again, truth may be stranger than fiction. It turns out that there have been a few scrapes and some bad blood between the rowdy U.S. and its polite northern neighbor. In fact, both the U.S. and Canada have plans on the books for full-scale war and seizure of each other's major cities. The American military plan was drawn up in the 1930s and is called War Plan Red, also the title of a slim and humorous little history by Kevin Lippert. The subtitle, The United States' Secret Plan to Invade Canada and Canada's Secret Plan to Invade the United States. Kevin Lippert, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you very much. My pleasure to be here.
I really did think this was a joke, like something from the plot of Infinite Jest. But it's funny that the history of conflicts between the U.S. and Canada exists and lies in the very foundation of both nations. They were originally one set of North American colonies. Why the split?
Well, after the Revolutionary War, and America felt that they had won the war, when they had the peace treaty negotiations in Paris, Benjamin Franklin had an idea which was, as long as we won the war, why don't you give us all of North America, including the Canadian provinces? The British at first agreed to that, but then backed off from that position and drew an imaginary line through the woods. These were days when the land just had not been explored, so they drew a line across the 47th and then later the 49th parallel and left it for later to actually locate the exact position of the border. So there was a lot of ambiguity about where the border was, and that led to numerous border tensions between the two countries.
Which really escalated in the War of 1812, when American troops thought that they would be welcomed as liberators as they invaded Quebec. They were not. What happened?
Well, there were, after the Treaty of Paris and the Revolutionary War, there were a lot of Americans who felt that somehow Canada was still owed to them. Among these, Henry Clay, who was an early Kentucky hothead, and President Madison at that time thought it would be easy, just a matter of marching, he said, an easy thing to march in and take over Canada. So during the Revolutionary War, the states had invaded Quebec because they assumed that the Canadians, like the Americans, would be eager to throw off the British. And they had that same assumption at least twice in the War of 1812. But some Canadians I spoke to in doing the research for the book feel that the War of 1812 was the war that cemented a Canadian sense of national identity. That was when foreigners invaded their territory, in this case the Americans, and that brought the British and the French closer together to repel the invasions.
Let's talk about some of these border skirmishes through the years. Wonderfully named Pork and Beans War of 1839. This is, as you put it, the only time in our history that an American state went to war with a foreign country. First, why the name?
Well, this was a war between lumberjacks in Maine and New Brunswick. And since pork and beans was the favorite food of lumberjacks, it became known as the Pork and Beans War. It's also known as the Roostock War, named after the Roostock County in Maine. Because of the fuzziness about the border between Maine and New Brunswick, lumberjacks from both countries or states and countries would routinely pass back and forth cutting down each other's trees. And there was one day when the Mainers had had enough. They invaded New Brunswick and they were promptly captured by the Canadians and put in chains and taken off to prison. And this caused an uproar in Washington. Lots of men were mobilized. $10 million was authorized to declare war on Canada. And at that point, the British ambassador said, there's nothing worth fighting over here. So he gave a lot of territory to the United States to resolve that conflict without a shot.
Another escalation to international incident without a shot, the shooting of a pig in 1859. What happened here?
This is the same story, just on the other side of the country. One of the places that was also poorly defined was San Juan Island off the coast of Washington State and Vancouver. And both British and Americans occupied that territory to try and take it as, claim it as their own. There were some American farmer squatters, and on the other side of the island, the Hudson's Bay Company, which was, of course, the giant trading, fur trapping corporation, British corporation that owned pretty much all of Western Canada, and including some of the eastern provinces and bits and pieces of Minnesota. So they owned an astonishing 3,000 square miles, and including, they thought, the Vancouver Island. One day, a British pig was rooting in the garden of an American farmer who shot the pig, and this caused what I liken to a Falklands-like buildup. The British sent in a bunch of warships. We sent in more warships and more troops. And then finally, their order came from Britain to attack the Americans. The British admiral said, to have two great nations go to war over a pig is ridiculous. So he declined the order, and that war was also happily resolved without any loss of life.
Except for the
pig. So that one's called the Pig War, except for the pig.
But, you know, it sounds like a sort of history of, I don't know, incompetence, of almost playing Risk in some kind of way.
Yes.
What's
and,
going
and
on
And nowhere
there?
Was there more incompetence than in the War of 1812, where American soldiers launched a series of ill-fated raids into Canada, most of which were ended tragically for the Americans. And including maybe the most humorous was the after the Civil War, there was a group of Irish Americans who formed what they called the Fenian Brotherhood, and they also called themselves the Irish Republican Army, the first known use of the acronym IRA. Their idea was to invade Canada and exchange it as a hostage with Britain for the freedom of Ireland. So there were numerous Fenian raids across the border, one of which was semi-successful but only encouraged more unsuccessful raids.
Why on earth would the U.S. want to invade Canada? Well, turns out that on a number of occasions, that question has been, why not? Kevin Lippert is with us. He's author of War Plan Red, the United States' secret plan to invade Canada, and Canada's secret plan to invade the United States. Okay, so you were born in Leeds, England. Your mother is a naturalized Canadian citizen, and you live in the U.S. now. What is it that we just don't get here in the U.S. about Canada? First of all, thinking that you could trade Canada for Ireland as if you were playing some kind of game. What are we missing here? Why don't we get it?
I'm not sure we ever got past the idea that somehow Canada doesn't belong to us. And toward the end of the book, I talk about War Plan Rumsfeld, the sort of post-9/11 political reality of how America basically took control of the Canadian military. And I don't think it was ever debated. I think there was just an assumption that Canada is sometimes called America's hat. Canada sits right next door to us. Since World War II, they've been under our shield, our umbrella of nuclear deterrence. So I think there's just a sense that somehow Canada belongs to the States and we can more or less do with it as we like.
Well, relations are much better between the U.S. and Canada than certainly they were during the Pork and Beans War. But now we have this alliance, the NORAD alliance, centered in a bunker. What can you tell us about this secret alliance?
Canada made a superhuman contribution to World War II, and I think that was something I was never aware of, that 1 million out of 11 million Canadians served in World War II, and from thin air they created the world's fourth largest Air Force and the world's fifth largest Navy. So they really stepped up to the plate and were a big factor in the victory in World War II, as a result of which, after the war, when we assumed our next war would be with Russia and not with Great Britain or Canada, Canada was invited to sit at the table with us at NORAD, which is the North American Air Defense, which was our nuclear shield to protect against a possible Soviet nuclear attack, in which Canada, probably not a target, but almost certainly collateral damage. And of the two commanding officers at NORAD, one is a Canadian and one is American. So they have equal footing at NORAD, at least. After 9/11, there were a couple of initiatives to expand that military collaboration, which resulted in an expansion of NORAD to include maritime, sea, and also land movements. So the post 9/11 version of NORAD, mm-hmm. the United States and Canada are very much intertwined militarily.
Well, War Plan Rumsfeld was very different than the more covert war plans that were drawn up in the 1930s. This is the War Plan Red. It was declassified in 1974. But it turns out that Canada had drawn up its own plan 10 years earlier, almost like eerily mirroring each other. What were the basics of the plans?
Which they very politely called Defense Scheme Number 1. This was drawn up by Canadian
military.
Wait,
I just have to stop for 1 second. It's defense with a C in that very Canadian
yes,
way.
Yes, of course.
But how passive aggressive is that to say it's a defense scheme when it's actually an offense scheme?
Well, it depends how, if you think Canadian politeness is passive aggressive. But it was a very passive aggressive scheme. The military officer who drew this up was a World War I vet, and he believed that a war between the United States and Britain was inevitable, and that the best defense would be a good offense. So he drew up a plan that would be a series of kind of blitzkrieg raids across the border. And he and a couple of his buddies had done some espionage in New England and upstate New York. They loaded into a Model T and took their Kodak Brownies and took a lot of pictures of bridges and roads that they were going to blow up as they retreated. His idea was you raid the United States, you withdraw, and that buys time for Britain to sail to your rescue. And that was never obviously acted on. But it's interesting, as you say, that the two plans are really mirror images of one another. I guess we each identified each other's weak points, being, for example, Albany, Sault Ste. Marie, Bellingham, Washington. And we would either attack from there or be attacked at those points.
But the United States plan, $57 million was allocated from Congress to follow through on this plan. One of the strategies was to create military airfields and disguise them as civilian airports, for example. So how far did this get?
I think that's as far as it got in terms of actual readying for a war. They built these airfields. They had the largest military exercise in American history to that point was held at Fort Drum. They had 36,000 troops assemble on the Canadian border and have war games for a possible invasion.
I guess the question is, hasn't America on some level already invaded Canada, you know, with television and movies and pop music and sports that aren't hockey?
I think the conclusion of the book is that for all intents and purposes, on many levels, we already are one country and we've sort of slipped quietly into peace through an invasion of sports, entertainment, and a complete commingling of trade and economics. We are each other's largest trading partner. So we worry in the States a lot about China, but in fact, Canada is a much larger trading partner for us. The border is still friendly and quite porous, and there are millions of people pass every year back and forth between the United States and Canada in both directions. And one interesting statistic I learned in writing the book was that there are 250,000 Canadians who live and work in New York City, which makes it Canada's 15th largest city.
Well, now and again, everybody talks about moving to Canada, you know, whether for free health care or education, or you get 18 months of maternity leave. Is that the
To escape some political craziness?
I thought I would let that one go. It's
okay,
been a while.
Now, well, we've got political craziness on the horizon that might prompt any of us to move up to Canada. But I've heard that comment from friends of mine on both ends of the political spectrum. If X is elected, I'm moving to Canada. But if we didn't have that safe haven, where would we go in order to maintain or find our sanity? And there are more concrete reasons besides finding some peace of mind. Canada, it turns out, has the world's second largest supply of oil and 20% of the world's fresh water. So they have some natural resources that we need and a lot of people think will be the subject of a future war. We've already had arguably 4 decades of war over oil, but a lot of people think fresh water will be the source of a next global conflict.
So we better cozy on up to Canada.
We better be nice.
Take some lessons from Canada. Well, Kevin Lippert, thank you. Thank you for your time.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
Kevin Lippert is the author of War Plan Red, The United States' Secret Plan to Invade Canada and Canada's Secret Plan to Invade the United States. It's a beautifully designed book, by the way. You can find more on the book at wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Immigration is a key issue among 2016 Republican presidential candidates, which Donald Trump claimed credit for at the Fox News debate in Cleveland.
If it weren't for me, you wouldn't even be talking about illegal immigration, Chris. You wouldn't even be talking about it.
When announcing his candidacy in June, Trump said that Mexico is sending immigrants, quote, bringing drugs, bringing crime, they're rapists. As embarrassing as his remarks were to the Republican Party, Trump is now polling far ahead of his GOP rivals, several of whom are now talking decisively about securing the border. But that is the border with Mexico. Given what we learned before the break about the secretive history of U.S.-Canada aggressions, it is high time that we look at the infiltration of seemingly well-mannered people from the North. Bill Curry is a columnist for Salon, an incurable political animal, and a really funny guy. He served as a Connecticut state senator, a public policy lawyer, and was counselor to the Clinton White House, where he worked as a domestic strategist. Finally, we found someone to address the maple menace.
Republican presidential candidates in New Hampshire are all talking about immigration. 16 good men and a woman who see New Hampshire's need to defend all its borders, not just the one with Vermont, who say what must be said. It's time to crack down on illegal Canadian immigrants. Liberals downplay the crisis. Canadians, they say, do jobs Americans won't do. Park ranger, goalie, microbrewer. But a closer look led social scientists to a startling discovery. Most of our problems are caused by Canadians. It took a while to see it, due to the speed with which Canadians assimilate. Slow in so many other ways, this talent for passing, both on and off the ice, made them virtually invisible to INS agents. In our in-country, and your average Canadian passes easily for a Mainer, or even a Minnesotan. The story of their detection is a public policy legend. When local officials first noticed a rising number of Canadian quarters in Buffalo parking meters, they thought little of it. It was the classic error of failing to assume any trend ticking slightly upward will go on doing so forever. Soon, parking meters across the Northeast were disgorging Canadian quarters like slot machines in a poorly run casino. A big blow to municipalities whose Chinese bankers threatened to, quote, come over there personally and empty the meters ourselves, unquote. The media was calling the crisis overblown. When scholars from the Cato Institute, flying over Canada en route to Bali for a 10-day conference on the upside of global warming, improvised an ingenious study. We looked out the window, said a senior fellow, and saw nothing but trees. It was like they emptied out the whole country. He surmised that crowds in NSA surveillance photos of Montreal were actors hired to conceal the mass migration and also satisfy employment quotas for American films being shot there. 30 million Canadians flooding our job markets kills wages. Compare the salary of an NHL wingman to that of a major league pitcher or NFL running back, and you'll see just what I mean. Most Canadians are English-speaking or American Canadians, but other Canadians, there's no delicate way to put this, are French. Their contempt for our customs and language infect many a workplace. I had a recent frustrating exchange with a Canadian-born physician. "Hey, boom, boom," I shouted. "Learn the language. The word is copay." Canadian illegals have caused a crime wave not seen since the Irish and Italians first washed up on our shores. From forest hideouts, they run the drug cartels they call internet pharmacies. They recruit couriers called moose to tread the perilous southern trail to senior centers just across the border. Our democracy itself is in peril. Democracy feeds on information, and Canadians are notoriously close-mouthed. Some won't even answer short tracking polls. Pressed, they offer cryptic replies like, "He seems nice," or, "I haven't had a chance to read up on that." Can they even sustain the steroidal rage modern politics demands of every citizen? We just don't know. It may be why our founding fathers gave up on the idea of acquiring Canada. They knew our problems all come from other places. We don't have to solve them, just keep them out.
Bill Curry writes a political column for Salon. He is former counselor to the Clinton White House. There's a link to read more of his columns at wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. 72 years ago, in the middle of World War II, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt traveled to the Canadian side of Lake Huron for an 8-day fishing trip. It was, by any measure, curious timing for a presidential holiday, and rumors began to fly. Was he having a clandestine meeting with Churchill, or perhaps a mistress? Years later, a retired professor of history was commissioned to investigate the vacation in order to discover what Roosevelt was actually doing in Canada back in 1943. Producer Jason Bull brings us the story.
In 1921, my great-grandmother bought 100 acres of Canadian wilderness for $600. Women didn't really do that in the 20s. She also wore pants and neckties. Women definitely didn't do that in the 20s. It's no coincidence Grandma Ruth made this Canadian investment just after the start of Prohibition back in the States. She had a pair of log cabins built immediately. She hosted lavish parties with my great-grandpa. They hauled in a piano from across the lake. People came from all around. The land has been in the family ever since. I've spent weeks at a time there my whole life, but only recently did I hear about a very famous tourist who visited the region for 8 days during World War II. And when I say famous, I mean extremely famous. Like so famous, it's not really believable. I'll try to set the stage for you. Imagine it's summer, 1943. America's still a newcomer to World War II. We've just been badly beaten by the Nazis in our first real engagement. But now the Allies are chasing the Germans out of Africa. We're beginning a risky push into Italy.
We land in the early hours of July the 10th.
General George Patton is marching the U.S. 7th Army through Sicily.
No bastard ever won war by dying for his country. He won it by making the other poor dumb bastard die for his country.
We're in the middle of the very first Allied invasion of Axis territory in Europe.
The liberation of Europe has begun.
And the President of the United States, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, what's he doing? Where's he? You guessed it.
Canada, the endless surprise.
Magical things to see coming up.
FDR is fishing in McGregor Bay, Ontario, Canada.
Come on.
August 1 through August 8, 1943.
Come on up.
If you asked around, the first thing you'd hear are conspiracy theories.
There are stories.
Funny little stories.
Roosevelt's mistress, Lucy Mercer Rutherford, was there.
Maybe they were doing business up here that other than fishing.
Rumors that Churchill was there.
Talks were going on. I don't know. It's hard to say.
Was this really just a fishing trip? And if it was, how did FDR pull it off? To find out, I did what anyone would do. I drove to the town of Little Current. It's on Lake Huron's Manitoulin Island, the largest freshwater island in the world. I'm inside Turner's department store.
Well, this is the map that everybody signed.
And this is Jib Turner.
We sold them the worms.
This man's grandfather sold the White House 2,000 worms. Think about that.
They immediately came to him for just about everything that they needed.
Worms, maps, telephone calls, fishing guides, and boat rental.
This is Jib's wife, Debbie Turner.
Yeah, we came across some bills from Turner's to the White House, and we're not sure if they were ever paid because they're not stamped paid.
Maybe go collect on that.
Exactly. Collect some interest now.
Do you suppose it was just a fishing trip, or is there any truth to any, you know, rumors of...
No, I think that a lot of things were probably blown out of proportion about the whole thing, but the reality was he was here to fish, and they did quite a bit of it, and they caught a lot of fish.
You turn into a big... Yeah, you're going to write a little poem on...
I'm trying to write do a story on this Roosevelt thing. So I hear you heard about it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I was 10.
This is Harold Golden. He's 82, and I'm going to call him the unofficial mayor of Willisville. It's a village of a few dozen residents and one stop sign. Harold is the epitome of a rural Canadian.
Yeah, I've been here all my life, yeah. Mm-hmm. Born 1933. I remember him coming to McGregor Bay.
What was happening? What was it like?
Well, he was in a wheelchair, and they had people looking after him, on the boat. He had a big boat, big warship.
The USS Wilmette kept guard over Roosevelt while he slept inside the Air Force One of train cars. Imagine a parked train along the water's edge with a massive warship meters away. Now back to Harold.
They stopped Reuben and I from going... going through the blasted channel, they stopped us there and searched the boat we were on and made sure we didn't have no guns or anything on the boat. They were guarding him pretty close, you know.
Harold said he didn't know anything about any FDR conspiracy theories. So at this point, I clearly needed an expert.
Hi, Graham.
Someone who could say, with conviction, whether any of these tall tales held any weight.
No, there's no weight to that at all. Yes, I'm Graham Mount, retired professor from the Department of History at Laurentian University in Sudbury, Ontario, Canada.
Graham knows a lot about U.S.-Canadian relations. And 15 years ago, he wrote what seems to me to be the definitive document on FDR's Canadian vacation.
Something I learned as a historian was that if there was an exciting version to a story... and there was a dull version to the story, the dull version was more likely to be the accurate one. He was there with his entourage from the White House. It was an opportunity for Roosevelt to have a rest before meeting Churchill a few weeks later in Quebec City for the fourth of their wartime meetings.
Okay, so I want to stop here to talk about infidelity. The mistress rendezvous theory has lived on this long, partly because it's so believable. FDR is known to have had several intimate female relationships, but none were quite as intimate as the one with Lucy Mercer. Some historians call Franklin and Lucy soulmates. In 1918, Eleanor caught Franklin red-handed. She found a swath of love letters in his suitcase. He pledged never to see Lucy Mercer again, but there's evidence that pledge was broken. Divorce was avoided to spare Franklin's political career, meaning Franklin and Eleanor essentially had a handshake relationship for the better part of three decades. Their son James called the marriage an armed truce that endured until the day he died. So if this holiday was just a fishing trip, I can buy that. Graham says it was gossip hounds who mistook the presidential secretary for a presidential mistress. And a Churchill summit was already on the docket for August 17th. So then why Canada? And why 1943?
The reason it took place at all, well, was this. Roosevelt, paralyzed from the waist down, couldn't go for walks. He liked cruises. And in 1943, the oceans were too dangerous. There was too much enemy submarine activity. The Great Lakes were safe. World War II was a marathon, not a sprint. There were critical moments, well, for 6 years, and there was no really convenient time to go. But it was unreasonable to expect somebody to go all that time without any break.
Presidents do need vacations, but the stress of war would take a toll on Roosevelt despite his fishing trip. In 1944, he was diagnosed with congestive heart failure, amongst other things. He looked broken down in photos and newsreels. Although he told the people of Ontario he would return to McGregor Bay, he never got the chance. He died of a brain hemorrhage in Georgia on April 12th, 1945. By his side, his soulmate, Lucy Mercer.
I propose to sail ahead. I feel sure that your hopes, I feel sure that your help is with me. For to reach a port, we must sail. Sail, not lie at anchor. Sail, not drift.
I'm Justin Bull on Manitoulin Island.
Word of mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. In December of 1606, a group of settlers sailed from London to plant seeds in the New World, more specifically on Jamestown Island in Virginia. Today, Jamestown is known for being the first English settlement in the colonies and a fiercely Protestant one. But recently, some seemingly Catholic relics were found buried with one of Jamestown's prominent leaders, Captain Gabriel Archer. The discovery is a shock for historians who may have discovered proof of an underground community of Catholics who pretended to be Protestants in early America. Dr. James Horn is president and chief officer at the Jamestown Rediscovery Foundation. Dr. Horn, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Good to be here.
Remind us of some of the background on Jamestown's first settlers.
Well, the first expedition, all male, about 104 men and boys, landed on Jamestown Island in May of 1607. And they were really a beachhead to establish a settlement that was intended to grow and intended to bring profit to the private company, the Virginia Company of London, that sponsored it. So it was both a effort to create a English presence in the New World, establish an English empire, if you like, in North America, and also an attempt to reap profits from the New World.
Who were they religiously? This was not yet the Puritans, were they?
Some Puritans did follow, but for the most part there, we would call them Anglican Church of England. So one key aspect of founding the settlement was founding also the Church of England in America.
So were there Catholics there?
Well, we have previously discovered some evidence of a Catholic presence, but didn't really pay too much attention to it. We've found some crucifixes, rosary beads, lockets, and other materials that we judged were Catholic origins. But we really kind of considered those in terms of some of the captives that were held at Jamestown from time to time in the early years. Two Spanish men were captured. A French Jesuit priest was captured. And they were prisoners at Jamestown. So we thought maybe those objects were related to those men. We didn't anticipate that one of the leading figures of early Jamestown might also be a Catholic.
Well, that's really the historic bombshell here when you and your team discovered the graves of four men, four very prominent Jamestown leaders. Well, first, were you looking for these graves in particular?
No, actually, we were looking for the church. And we discovered that 5 years ago in 2010. And this, just to underline it once more, this is the first English church in America, and therefore certainly the first Church of England structure in America. And in looking at the east end of the church, saw the four burials in a row. So that indicated to us that this was very likely the chancel, and if that were the case, then we assumed they would all be prominent. But of course, there were no indications of who they were. They'd been forgotten for 400 years, and so the next task was to do research, sufficient research, to identify them.
Who were they, the four?
Well, we have the first Anglican minister, the Reverend Robert Hunt. We have the first English knight buried in America, Sir Ferdinando Wainman. Another military man who was related to Lord Delaware. His name was Captain William West. And finally, we have one of the most prominent leaders of early Jamestown, Captain Gabriel Archer.
So the relics that were buried with Captain Gabriel Archer's body on the site of this first church built at Jamestown, what were the relics?
Well, there are two artifacts, and very rare to find artifact in a grave, and usually if you do find them, indicates that the person is very high status. We found a segment, a portion of what's called a captain's leading staff. This is kind of like a spear, and it was a symbol of rank. It was used by captains to rally the troops. And so that indicated that we had someone who was of that rank, a captain. But the real surprise, without any question, was the discovery of a small silver box, which was placed on top of the coffin, not inside it, and it was deliberately placed there. It was very clearly, carefully arranged on top of the coffin near the feet of Gabriel Archer, and very clearly also was put there at the time of the burial. So one obvious question is, who put it there? We could not open it, and we still can't open this little box. The box itself is hexagonal in shape. It's silver alloy. There's copper in it. It's not English. We know that because it doesn't have a hallmark. So it was made in continental Europe, but we don't know when it was made, and we don't know where it was made.
But you do know what's inside. You've taken some, what, sort of X-ray photograph?
Yeah, we had to figure out a way of seeing inside the box without opening it. So initially we did X-rays, and we got some intriguing information. We knew there was something in it because you could hear it was hollow. And then we took it for very high-resolution CT scanning and used some of the most up-to-date equipment in the world to do this. And what that revealed was that the box is packed full of bone and that there were two small lead fragments, which were halves, two halves of a small lead container called an ampulla that would have contained holy water, holy oil, or possibly blood. So that gave us the clue that this is a reliquary. We haven't ruled out that it could be Anglican, but all the evidence points to it being a Catholic reliquary and a form of Catholic reliquary that is known as a primary relic, one that would be used in public devotion rather than as a private object.
We're talking with James Horn, an historian who is among those who discovered the graves of four very early, very prominent English settlers on the island of Jamestown off of the coast of Virginia, one of whom was buried with Catholic artifacts in his grave, completely throwing a wrench in our concept of early American history and that settlement at Jamestown. These reliquaries, you see them all over old churches in Europe, you know, they supposedly contain the shards of a bones of a saint or maybe a fragment of cloth from Catherine of Siena's dress or something like this. They hold these important sacred objects. And that is a strictly Catholic thing?
Generally, yeah. And there are other world religions that draw upon the same tradition. And of course, as you say, there is a spiritual power that the object is imbued with. So this is a very precious object to not just to the person who brought it to the New World, but also, I suspect, to a larger community of Catholics who would have been at Jamestown.
It is remarkable, especially because, you know, this wasn't just another citizen. This was a leader. This was one of the formative men of the settlement at Jamestown. And now, at the time, did settlers or members of the Church of England have the same kind of hostility against the Catholics that maybe Puritan colonists in New England did?
It certainly would be the case that none of the leaders could profess Catholicism. That would rule you out straight away. And if you weren't attending church because of your Catholic beliefs, then you could be fined or even put in jail. And anyone that was preaching Catholicism, that could be a death penalty. So there certainly were very strict rules and regulations for Catholics. On a parish level in England, there might have been more of a turning a blind eye, as long as there was no attempt to undermine the authority of the official state church or to undermine the authority of the magistrates or rulers, and particularly, of course, the monarch. Bear in mind also that we're talking here about Jamestown in 1608, 1609. That's only a few years after the gunpowder plot in London, where mm-hmm. an attempt was made by Catholics to blow up the Houses of Parliament and King James in it. So there is a good deal of fear of Catholics. And when you combine that with the fear of Catholic invasion or the Spanish trying to invade England, you can see that this discovery plays into a much, much bigger picture of Protestants versus Catholics in Europe.
What are some of the theories that you and your colleagues and historians have come up with about the presence of this Catholic iconography in the grave of a prominent Protestant leader?
We think that Gabriel Archer might well have been a secret Catholic, and more than that, it's even possible he was a Catholic priest, and that he was the leader of a secret cell of Catholics at Jamestown, possibly with the intention of undermining the colony from within.
Wow, so that's really something.
So that's certainly one line of investigation we're pursuing. We've got a lot more research to do, but that ultimately is the way we're thinking about this.
Wow, that is a huge discovery. And the start of American Catholicism, supposedly in the U.S., began much later, closer to the 19th century with the influx of Irish and German immigrants. But this just changes our whole concept of early American settlements.
Well, I think it means, first of all, that to understand early American history, it's necessary to have a understanding of what was going on in Europe. Spain is the superpower of the day, Catholic Spain. And these wars that took place throughout this period, 16th and 17th century, between the Catholics and the Protestants, spill over to America. So the British colonies in America are drawn into that conflict, whether they liked it or not. And that, as we've discovered now here at Jamestown, begins at the very start of English colonization.
Well, it is just fascinating. Please keep us posted, Dr. Horn, and thank you so much for speaking with us.
You're more than welcome. Thank you.
James Horn, he's president of the Jamestown Rediscovery Foundation, and you can learn much more about the foundation and the recent discovery of these mysterious artifacts at our website. That's at wordofmouthradio.org. Thanks so much for your listening time today. There's much more to hear and explore at wordofmouthradio.org. And you can listen to the Word of Mouth podcast anytime. You can find it by searching on iTunes for Word of Mouth NHPR. And if you like the podcast, please write a review and pass it on. Tell a friend. After all, the best suggestions travel by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. We'll be back with more Word of Mouth tomorrow, too, here on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
Molly Donahue,
Megan Tan,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
Our intern is Fiona Shea.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire
Public Radio.